This is Speaking Freely. I am Annette Newell. Glad you're joining me. I'm calling this episode The Final Election Push. Ballots are mailed out and in voters' hands as candidates make their final pitches leading up to November 8th Election Day. The candidates for Oregon governor held their final debate, sponsored by our news partner KGW and The Oregonian. Here are some of the highlights. Independent Betsy Johnson described Oregon's pandemic school lockdowns as
the single worst thing we did during COVID was to shut kids out of the classroom, enforced shutting them out of the classroom for 2 years. We're already realizing the academic damage that we did as test scores are coming in and they are appalling.
Republican Christine Drazen blamed Democrats for kids' learning loss.
Kate Brown and Tina Kotek threw our kids under the bus. I know how hard it is to watch your students suffer. And that's what kids across our state were doing during the COVID lockdowns. We had some of the longest lockdowns in the nation, and our kids all suffered. It was hard on teachers, it was hard on families, but worst of all, it was hard on our kids. And as a member of the legislature, I proposed legislation to fully fund schools.
But Democrat Tina Kotek says Drazen voted against school funding.
Christine Drazen threw our students under the bus when she voted against the Student Success Act in 2019. She chose corporate special interests over actually adding $1 billion more per year to our schools, that fortunately we have those resources now to build out from what has occurred during the pandemic.
Oregon's public defender crisis also emerged as a major issue of the debate. That shortage of public defenders means people charged with crimes are being set free. Republican Christine Drazen places the blame for that on Democrats, specifically her opponent, Tina Kotek.
Our public defenders have been underfunded for years. And this is an issue that we have to address. We have got to protect victims. We've got to ensure that at the same time, people have their day in court. And my opponent in this one, we're talking about Tina Kotek's leadership on this issue. She dramatically underfunded our public defenders for years as Speaker of the House. And instead of working for solutions on this issue, she has allowed it to remain. And now this system is in fact broken. The solutions that have been proposed have had a variety of fiscal impacts. And what we need to do is to be able to manage the fiscal impacts while ensuring that we have adequate coverage in these offices.
Independent candidate for Governor Betsy Johnson says the current public defender system needs reform, but she wouldn't tear it all up and start from scratch.
I would not replace because that would be too difficult. I would overhaul. In my observation, the agency has not been well run for a long time. The contract attorneys that do business with the agency had a hard time getting contracts out and ratified. The contracts were applied differently in different geographic areas. We've expanded the scope, causing there to be huge caseload problems.
But Democrat Tina Kotek accused her opponents of not recalling the state's own research on what would actually solve the problems.
My opponents seem to have a little lapse in memory. We all supported studies to look at our system, and there is a great study that says we need to change what we're doing. I will say here that we need to change how we're providing public defense services around the state. We need to pay our attorneys better. They need lower caseloads, and I do believe it has to be centralized out of the state. What we're doing right now is not working, and is undermining our justice system, is not allowing people to get due process. And folks who are victims can't get served either if someone doesn't have a lawyer and then that person is let go. We must solve this, and it's another failure from Governor Brown of not paying attention to a key cornerstone of our public safety system, and that's not acceptable, and we're going to fix that when I'm governor.
Polls continue showing a statistical dead heat between Democrat Kotek and Republican Drazen, with support for Independent Johnson falling behind. That extremely tight race brought President Biden to Portland.
What a governor does matters. It matters. It matters. It matters. It matters.
Along with Kotek, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden joined the president. I talked to the senator about this campaign and election season. I'm doing a show. I'm calling it Final Election Push. So I would love to get your thoughts about this election cycle in general and specifically what you think about the governor's race and what's going on with that in Oregon.
Yeah, look. There are many, many Oregonians who have fallen between the cracks in this economy. You look, for example, at prescription drugs. You know, I was the lead author of this legislation so that Medicare could finally negotiate to hold down the cost of medicine. We're making some progress on insulin, but next year we'll finally start negotiations on the most expensive drugs. cancer and arthritis drugs. I mean, these are the kinds of costs that are really socking it to Oregonians in the wallet. And I think that's reflected in terms of voter attitudes. They're going to support people who are going to deliver on those kinds of issues, have a track record of delivering on those kinds of issues. Saw the Kotek commercial last night on insulin. I mean, insulin has been an enormous national scandal. I mean, essentially, insulin today is the same insulin we've had for decades and decades. The only thing people get are higher prices. So when I saw that commercial, it made me realize that what this is all about is trying to make life more affordable for Oregonians, and she's doing that, and I support her.
And not only is the governor's race looking competitive right now, it's also the congressional races. Three of them are looking competitive. So what's at stake in Oregon this election cycle? We're talking about a major shift in leadership.
Yeah, there are big policy directions. For example, I think our candidates, the three women who are running very focused, issue-oriented campaigns, they want to make sure we don't turn back the clock in our state. I mean, we've had solid laws to protect reproductive rights for women in our state. Now, after National Republicans said, oh, this is a state's rights issue, this whole question of abortion and reproductive health, they've done an about-face, and they've now said they're for a national abortion ban. You have a federal national abortion ban, and you basically unravel all of what has been done in Oregon to protect the reproductive rights of women. So it's those kinds of issues that are going to drive the race. I think the two, you know, the two big issues, what I've focused on in my campaign, are the issues that go to making life more affordable for Oregonians. You know, we've got a spot about my role as chairman of the Finance Committee where we're taking on these ridiculous tax breaks that big oil, you know, rakes in. It comes down to a question for me. And you see my gas station in our neighborhood, it's a question of, are you going to stand up for the Oregon mom who's trying to afford gas to take their kid to childcare, or are you going to be on the side of these big oil tax breaks where instead of doing the work they need on their leases so there's more production or carbon capture to protect the environment, you know, what they're doing is doling out more stock buybacks to their wealthy executives.
What was it like to be at the president's visit to Oregon this time? I saw the part where he called you one of the best senators in generations.
It's always a little bit of inflation at these rallies, but he has talked to me often over the years, particularly about issues that we're focused on, like, you know, healthcare and technology, investing in infrastructure. He's very much an infrastructure guy, roads and bridges and transportation systems. He and President Obama very much like my Build America Bonds approach, which generated millions for investment in Oregon's infrastructure. So we worked together in the Senate, and I really like, as I mentioned at the rally, I like the way he focused on taking on big pharma. If you look at the speech he gave at the State of the Union, no president, I'm not talking about Democrats or Republicans, no president took on big pharma, and he had all of us up in the White House. And he basically, as we say in basketball, came to play every day. He said, who do I need to talk to? We buttonholed people. And when he was in town, there was an amazing day about 7-8 weeks ago on the floor of the United States Senate, and that was senior citizens and taxpayers beat big pharma with respect to this whole issue of containing costs, and that's never happened before.
Tell me about this practice of bringing in people like President Biden, and this weekend we're going to have Senator Elizabeth Warren, also a former presidential candidate, coming to Oregon. There was, on the other side, Republican Glenn Youngkin came this week, governor of Virginia, to support Christine Drazen. Why are we getting these kind of political heavy hitters in this go-around?
Well, first, Annette, and you can probably gather from what I've said already, I've always felt that the best politics is good policy. So you and I have just been talking about gas prices and holding down health care costs and making life more affordable. Each race brings in their own folks. So, you know, Southern Oregon brings other people than the metropolitan areas. And the bottom line is what you want to do in our state, where a lot of people are walking an economic tightrope, balancing the food bill against a rent bill and the rent bill against a car insurance and the like is focus in on these wallet issues. And I think these are good candidates that we've got out there, and they're bringing in thoughtful people who have a national profile on some of these key issues, particularly the economy and protecting health care for women.
Speaking of money, you got some new money to talk about for the counties, $113 million in federal aid over the next 2 years. What are some of the highlights of that?
A number of years ago, I wrote the Secure Rural Schools Bill, and this was a particularly important law. It's brought Oregon about $3.5 billion for local roads and schools and basic services. A lot of folks in rural areas have said to me, Ron, without your law, we would have schools 3 days a week. Even with that, there's just been a world of hurt in rural Oregon. It was really tough before the pandemic. In a lot of places, it's even tougher now. Senator Mike Crapo, Republican of Idaho, and I are teaming up for a longer-term approach for making sure that rural communities can pay for roads and health services and schools and the like. This $113 million was a kind of interim approach that I put into the Recovery Act in 2021 as chairman of the Finance Committee. And I said, look, these rural communities have just been shellacked by COVID, and this money is going primarily to the rural areas. You have communities like Douglas County getting $10 million, Jackson County getting $4.5 million, Josephine, $5 million. These are places that have really been hurting. Now here it's going to have $12 million. And what we're trying to do is make sure that as our rural communities are focused on coming back from a pandemic and supply chain problems and all the rest, that they're going to have money for the building blocks, which I always consider transportation, communications, particularly broadband. We announced a major broadband expansion a few days ago through the Department of Agriculture and Healthcare. And these funds are the building blocks for economic recovery.
Let's switch to wildfires for a moment here. You know, we had the big fire, the Nikia Creek fire. Fortunately, people are able to go back to their homes now, but they had to evacuate because the thing just blew up really fast on Sunday. And then we had the world's worst air again, unfortunately, for a while. Now, that seems to have cleared out and calmed down. However, we're still seeing this big impact from the wildfires. Now, I know you were pressing for a better plan, a greater plan for the interior on that.
Yeah, I was with the wonderful people at Clackamas Fire yesterday. And these are such terrific men and women. You know, when they sign up, Clackamas Fire, and they are looking at a 25-year commitment, knowing that every time they leave the house in the morning, something may happen and they may not come home and they won't be there for their spouse and their kids and the like. And so what we talked about were ways with salaries and retirement, you know, benefits, that it be possible to recruit more of these superb individuals, because, you know, what we need right now with the growing number of fires. I mean, we always say the Oregon congressional delegation used to have a meeting like in July before the summer break, and that was fire season. Now the fire season is all year round. You know, people just in the last couple of days are dealing with smoke. So what I put at the center of the effort for reform is to get more firefighters, and you do that with better pay and the dignity of retirement down the road after 25 years. And there's a lot to do there. And some of the instances I heard from Clackamas Fire folks, it also requires a better partnership between the federal government and the states. The men and women yesterday were telling me that in some instances, money that was intended or should be intended for them was getting, in effect, lost in the pipeline from the state. And so I'm working on trying to get more firefighters through better salaries and retirement and opportunities for their family. It is urgent business when the metro area has some of the world's worst air quality, and that's what we've seen over the last few days. And then in the woods, I'm getting more money for thinning. So you go in there and thin out those dead and dying materials that are just magnets for fire.
And that was my talk with Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. For more background on the importance of elections like the one we have coming on November 8th, I also talked to a historian who's authored a new book, Civil War by Other Means.
My name is Jeremy Suri, and I'm a professor of history and public policy at the University of Texas at Austin in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs.
Okay, and you are launching a brand new book about the Civil War and about how it actually continued past what we think of as commonly as the end of the Civil War. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. The book is basically about the legacies of the Civil War. So the book is focused on the periods from when the Civil War ends up to the present and the ways in which the end of the Civil War and the disputes in the decades after that war continue to infect and distort our politics today.
Can you give me some examples of how they continue to affect our politics today?
Absolutely. The most basic and obvious one, especially as we're in midterm election season, is how we vote. The 15th Amendment, which was ratified after the Civil War, it was ratified because of the Civil War as slaves became citizens. The 15th Amendment says you cannot deny someone the right to vote based on race, but it still allows states to deny people the right to vote for various other reasons. And so as a consequence, since 1870, states have become very inventive in keeping people away from the ballot box, particularly minorities and women in many cases. And that's a bug, that's a feature of that amendment and the way the law was written in 1870. And as I show in the book, that was not an accident. Many white leaders and many Democratic and Republican leaders did not want everyone to be able to vote, even though the Civil War was ostensibly fought to enable everyone to be a citizen. The idea was not to allow everyone to vote. And so as a consequence, we have a system that doesn't actually protect voting for every citizen.
You know, this really draws some comparisons to what's going on right now in the Pacific Northwest. I know that the secretaries of state for both Oregon and Washington have already had these pretty incredible press conferences where they're laying out, oh my goodness, we're getting just bombarded with all these requests for FOIA requests for information. And they've never seen this amount of people asking them for information, implying that there's cheating going on in our electoral process.
And this is a very old story as well. So in the 1870s and 1880s, when large numbers of new citizens, often African-American, but sometimes immigrants coming to the Pacific Northwest, to Oregon, for example, started to vote as they had not voted before, those who didn't like the way they voted accused them of fraud. And the 1876 presidential election, which echoes the 2020 presidential election, was an election where the then Democrats, who are really the equivalent of the today Republicans, claimed that large numbers of votes that were not for them were somehow fraudulent and wanted to launch investigations. There was even a Supreme Court investigation, an electoral commission that included Supreme Court justices that investigated these claims of fraud in 1876. So this is an old story, and we haven't gotten that out of our system. That's the point of my book.
And there's some accusations of wrongdoing already that have been going on. The Washington Secretary of State's press conference recently where he's saying, look, there's all these crazy rumors online that are going around
right.
that are wrong.
Right.
We're trying right. to tamp them down. And, you know, I've covered elections for well over a decade. I've never seen them preemptively say, hey, look, there's all these crazy rumors that are not true going on.
Well, and I think social media has taken on the role of what the rumor mill was in the 1870s and 80s. So these kinds of false accusations, this kind of departure from the truth, was common in circles of organized activists who were concerned about new people taking over their communities in the years after the Civil War. And I think social media has come to play the same role. Many of these social media trolls, they're making these wild accusations, not because they really care about voting, but because they care about trying to control their communities and they don't want other people having a say.
Fascinating. Another thing I wanted to touch on with you is what's going on in Iran right now. And they seem like they are on the brink of maybe already embroiled in their own civil war over women's rights.
Yes. So this is an ongoing process, a long process in Iran. We've seen repeated moments going back to the early 21st century when Iranian citizens, particularly women, have risen up against what is a terribly oppressive, chauvinist, violent regime. And the challenge is that this regime has such a strong hold on the security forces in Iran, that it's very hard to push through any reforms. There has been change from time to time in elected officials, but it is these mullahs, these religious figures who fundamentally control the system. And I think the resonance for my book in that, because my book is not about Iran, of course, but the resonance is to recognize that one of the real challenges to democracy is not just the institutions, but it's the bullying and the use of violence by bullies, by repressive actors. That's what's preventing these women right now from being able to live their lives as they want to live their lives. They're not necessarily pro-American. They just want to be able to live as they wish to live and not be forced to wear a chador and all these other things. The same is true to some extent in American society in the 1870s and 80s, where violent groups like the Ku Klux Klan and the Red Shirts and others throughout our country, including in Oregon, are using violence to intimidate people. Democracy must be about the elimination of paramilitary violence by groups that are using that violence for their own power.
Yeah, and we have an unfortunate history in Oregon of being a white, I think the only actually officially white supremacist state in the union, where it was actually written in the state constitution that yes. Black people were not allowed here. So there's still that history, and yet the people here are considered to be more liberal than America on average, which is really an interesting combination.
Well, and I love visiting Oregon, as I've done many times, obviously Portland and also Southern Oregon and elsewhere. And I see what you're saying. I mean, it's a society and a state where people are welcoming, certainly, but also where they are very free in their lifestyle. And I think that really reflects well on the community. But I think why we must study this history, Annette, is because even though it might be a more welcoming, open society today, there are vestiges of this history in our institutions and in our attitudes that we don't always see. We don't study history to condemn people or to try to create perpetrators in our present world. This is not to make anyone feel guilty, but it's to recognize that there are things we've inherited that continue to shape and distort how we behave, as is true in any family, right? We've inherited things from grandma and grandpa, good and bad. And the same is true here. So Oregon, like every other state, certainly like Texas, my state, would be well served not to hide this history, but to understand this history and then honestly say, what can we do to overcome this history, to get ourselves beyond it? That's not about condemning anyone. Mm-hmm. But it's about learning how this history has shaped us and learning to do better. I think that's what we try to do in every family, and I hope it's what we can do in our politics.
Mm-hmm. Some of the rhetoric that we're hearing and some of the local ads for politicians right now is we're going to let the families decide what their kids are going to learn in the classroom.
Yeah, I'm an educator. I'm a teacher myself, obviously, so I have a very strong position on this. I don't go to the airport and tell the pilot how to fly the plane, and I don't tell the surgeon how to do the surgery. I mean, this is silly. It really is. What we need to do is train the best possible teachers, and I do a lot of work with teachers around the state of Texas and around the country. We need to invest more in recruiting the most talented people to be teachers and invest in training them and then let them do their jobs. Mm-hmm. That's the same thing we do with pilots, right? I want the pilot on my Southwest or American Airlines flight or whatever to be trained by the Air Force. I want the best trained person, and then I want to let them fly the plane. Mm-hmm. And this micromanaging of teachers by families that are usually well-intentioned but don't know anything more about history than they know about flying a plane, it makes no sense at all.
Yeah, we even have a candidate right now and saying, you know, get back to the basis of education and get this kind of woke stuff out of there.
You know, what we're talking about now is the basics. You can't understand our society if you don't understand the history of slavery in our society. And I will say I love our country. I'm the child of immigrants. You're not going to find anyone who loves America more than me. I wouldn't be alive. I wouldn't get to do what I did if the United States had not been a savior for my family fleeing pogroms in Russia and fleeing starvation in India. So I love the United States, but I love the United States so much that I want us to know our history so we can do better. In the same way, I want my kids, who I love dearly, to see the limitations in their activities and improve. That's what we talk about at dinner every night, right? We can all improve. And so the basics are often the stuff that certain people don't want us to teach because they're uncomfortable about it. Just as my students are uncomfortable when they get a B, but I have to give them a B when they haven't done A work. And we need to know our history, including the history of slavery and other uncomfortable parts of our history, because it's the only way we can improve. And if you love your country, just as you love your children, you want your society to learn and improve.
Biden is going to be here on Friday in Portland. So give me your best educated guess about why he's showing up here.
I think he's showing up there because he doesn't want a Republican elected governor of Oregon. And he's trying to motivate people to vote for, I guess, one of the two other candidates you have. As I understand, you have three candidates for governor.
That's true.
And
yes.
And so he is. I think he's coming for that reason primarily, is my guess. And I think also to provide a different image of Portland. I think, as your listeners know well, Portland is an extraordinary city. I've been there maybe four or five times. It's a city that has so many good things going for it. Of course, it has challenges. Every city does. I live in Austin, Texas. We have challenges as well as great opportunities. But Portland has been used as a whipping boy because of this false image of what was happening there the last few years. And so I think he's also trying to change the image of that and counteract propaganda.
I would agree with that. As somebody who covered all of that stuff for the last couple of years, it's been my life, and the governor's race too. So
I've been to Portland many times. I've always felt safe in Portland. And a big shout out to Powell's Books and all
yes.
the wonderful businesses in Portland. I mean,
yes.
it's an extraordinary city. I want our country to look like Portland, not to look like what people will say on the other side.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more in depth about your book. Who would benefit most from reading your book?
I hope anyone who is interested and cares about democracy, our democracy, and the future of our democracy would want to read my book, because what I try to show in the book is how many of the challenges we have today really go back to this period after the Civil War. The book opens with January 6th, but then it goes back to the assassination of Lincoln. And you can see much of the same rhetoric around John Wilkes Booth and his many supporters. And you can see that rhetoric continue in the 1870s. And the point of my book is not to offer any easy solution for what we do today, but for us to understand that the problems we face are not problems just about a particular president or presidential candidate or a particular member of Congress. There are deeper issues. There are deeper cancers in our system. And these are cancers that we can remove. The book is optimistic. The book loves America. But we can't remove these cancers if we don't diagnose them. And we talked about one already, voting. We should have the most secure voting rights in the world because we're supposed to be the best democracy. This should not even be a debatable proposition. There should be a right to vote just as there's a right to free speech. We need a constitutional amendment which would prevent states like Texas from messing with your right to vote. We should have limits on gerrymandering. Gerrymandering goes back to the 18th century, but it begins to really be used in the ways we see today in the 19th century. And a variety of things of this sort. We need to fix the Electoral College. These are all cancers within our system that are made much worse. They metastasize after the Civil War, and they've metastasized again now. And our opportunity, if we diagnose them correctly, is to actually then talk about removing them. And that's what my book is for. It's not a Democratic or Republican book. It's a book about understanding where our problems came from and what we can do with them. Again, the parenting analogy, I have teenagers, so I think about parenting all the time.
Of course.
I'm not necessarily good at it. I mean, my wife's a much better parent than I am, but I think about it that way. I can't help my kids if they have a problem, if I don't know where the problem comes from. And same thing, that's the point of my book.
Best of luck to you, and let us know when you're in Portland.
I certainly will, and thank you, Annette. Wonderful talking to you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Take care.
And that was my talk with history and public affairs professor Jeremy Suri, the author of the new book, Civil War by Other Means. You're listening to Speaking Freely with Annette Newell. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you have an idea for a topic for this show, please email it to me to annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. One more time, that's annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. Be sure to join us again next week and check out our Speaking Freely podcast on KXL.com.